It's warming, it's because of us, we're sure, it's bad, but we can fix it. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, March 24th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the irrefutable science of climate change meets the passions and hesitations of regular people. We're joined by one of the world's leading global sustainability scientists. We'll talk about her new book, Under the Sky We Make. Is Defend Title IX Now a political misstep for Governor Kristi Noem? We'll talk about the Bare Bones website and the national response to her plea for support. Leadership might change, but the corn jokes stay the same. We check in on the world's only corn palace. But first, bovine tuberculosis has been detected in a South Dakota herd for the first time since 1982. That's ahead. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The potential for Medicaid expansion in South Dakota just got more complicated. Dakotans for Health wants a ballot measure next year to let voters decide on expanded coverage. They're now asking the state Supreme Court to delay a legislative resolution that increases the number of votes needed for a ballot question to pass. Rick Weiland is with the group. He says the legislature's move thwarts the will of the voters.
And it intentionally stopped a grassroots effort to bring health care and hundreds of millions of dollars back to our state, federal dollars that we pay in. And we think it's wrong.
Lawmakers passed a joint resolution asking voters to change how many votes it takes to pass ballot questions that raise taxes or spend $10 million. Instead of a simple majority, it would take 60% to pass. Legislators placed their resolution on the 2022 primary ballot. That's just months before the Medicaid expansion measure would appear on the general election ballot. South Dakota voters rejected a similar threshold increase for constitutional amendment questions in 2018. The South Dakota Supreme Court has heard a second appeal stemming from a battle over a family ranch near Pukwana. Attorneys for both sides of the Healy family dispute made their cases before justices Tuesday. One issue is whether a lower court erred by not including costs around $100,000 of attorneys' fees. Victoria Wicks has more of this story for SDPB.
Brett Healy sued his family in 2017 to challenge the sale of the ranch. A lower court judge found that his lawsuit was frivolous and malicious and awarded more than $83,000 in attorney's fees to the family. Brett Healy appealed that decision to the South Dakota Supreme Court, which in 2019 affirmed the lower court and awarded another $18,000 plus in attorney's fees. The case went back to the lower court with a different judge. In late summer 2020, he voided legal fees after finding that the earlier record did not establish Healy's intentions when he filed suit. Joe Erickson represents Brett Healy's family, who appeal that ruling.
This case can be best described as the same song, second verse, of Brett Healy's continued litigation of his Healy Ranch partnership claim.
Erickson says Brett Healy filed a claim of interest to slander the title and prevent the sale. And he says state law allows attorney's fees as costs under those circumstances.
There was evidence presented to the court, and the judge went through and made different findings and conclusions of law, and this court affirmed those findings.
The attorney for Brett Healy disagrees.
Appellant describes this case as a second verse of the same song, but I think it's more apt to describe this case as perhaps a subsequent song on the same album.
Angie Schneiderman says in its 2019 opinion, the Supreme Court left ownership of the ranch to be settled later. Schneiderman says Brett Healy did not file his lawsuit to botch the sale of the ranch, but to establish title.
When I think about this case being couched in terms of being a quiet title action, essentially what that does is a plaintiff saying to the world, tell us your claims to this property or forever hold your peace.
Schneiderman says as long as there are still existing disputes, the case is not over. Supreme Court justices have taken the case under advisement and once again will issue an opinion at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
Today's weather, sunny skies in the west, cloudy in the southeast, with highs in the lower 40s to the lower 50s across the state. Evening lows in the lower 20s to the lower 30s. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The first case of bovine tuberculosis has been identified in South Dakota. It's the first such case since 1982. Dusty Odukhovan is the South Dakota State Veterinarian, and he joins us now with details. Dr. Odukhovan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thank you.
I want to talk about the impact on humans, if there is any, but first, what is this disease for cattle?
Yeah, well, tuberculosis is a there's bovine tuberculosis is primarily the strain of tuberculosis that affects cattle, and humans can acquire bovine tuberculosis, although it's much more rare in the United States. We've had an eradication program in the United States for bovine tuberculosis since the early 1900s. And South Dakota has been recognized as free from that disease since 1982. But we have had more recent cases. The most recent herd in South Dakota was in 2017. And one of the primary concerns with the disease in today's, you know, nowadays, I guess to say, is that the finding of TB may impact cattlemen's ability to market their cattle in interstate commerce. Because if we were to lose our TB-free status, there would be additional costs in testing cattle for TB as they moved interstate. So that's one of the primary concerns. We don't have a food safety concern or a public health concern, but it is a concern to cattlemen.
How was this discovered?
We have a very robust food safety system in the U.S., which includes having inspectors at look at each carcass as they are processed, and so. This ranch in Corson County had marketed some coal cows through a South Dakota auction market, and those cows were bought and taken to a processing plant in Minnesota where an astute inspector had noticed signs consistent with tuberculosis. So samples were collected and sent to the lab, and they did confirm tuberculosis. And so then using records to go back through that system, we were able to identify the herd of origin. We did live animal testing in that herd, and we did find and confirm additional infected animals there.
Does it usually take until an inspector at that point in the supply chain to discover bovine tuberculosis?
In the United States, yes. That's the production expectations of our livestock are high. We're typically finding, and our food safety system is very robust, as I mentioned. And so typically that is how we find tuberculosis in cattle in the United States, is through the slaughter surveillance program. When we did find additional infected animals in this herd, they were in good condition. Signs consistent with TB in a chronically affected animal would be respiratory disease, wasting, that sort of thing, but we're not usually, those animals aren't staying in our herds in the United States long enough to show those signs. So slaughter surveillance is where we find those infections.
Let's go back to what you were talking, Dusty, about the free status of free of bovine tuberculosis in South Dakota. What happens next with the investigation to make sure that all the steps were taken to maintain that or retain that free status?
Right, and USDA is the grantor of that status, and the steps are pretty well clearly laid out in uniform methods and rules that we follow. All state animal health officials working closely with USDA officials will work together to conduct this investigation as thoroughly and efficiently as we can, and so that'll involve looking at sales out of the herd. Sales into the herd, testing those herds that may be associated with this index herd, and also testing neighboring herds. We'll also work with wildlife officials to try and determine if the disease has spread into wildlife in the area, such as deer. And a complete investigation, I think, is critical in demonstrating that we can maintain our free status.
When might we expect more about that investigation? How long do these sort of things take to unfold?
Well, we are testing additional herds this week, ongoing, and we'll probably continue that process for several months. That's you know, it takes a lot of time. And of course, this time of year, many producers are starting to calve, and that creates some difficulty in handling those cattle. We want to do so as low stress as possible so that we're not impacting the production of those herds. So that takes some time and patience to get through. But, you know, we'll have more information in the coming months for sure. And then, you know, as we decide, you know, how we're going to handle this herd, you know, that'll probably become more evident again in the next weeks to months as we determine the extent of the spread of infection.
Dr. Dusty Otakovin is the South Dakota State Veterinarian. Dr. Otakovin, thanks for being here with us today and for updates in the future.
Okay, thank you, Lori.
Up next, we will look at a little medical news of the day as you head into the spring sunshine. How to take care of your skin. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
What happens when two distant relatives find each other on the internet, but one is aligned with Antifa and the other with a right-wing militia?
He knows what I do. I know what he does. At the end of the day, we're still cousins.
I'm Audie Cornish. That story and the latest from the mass shooting in Boulder, Colorado, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. State lawmakers considered more than 500 pieces of legislation this year. We reviewed the key issues with legislative leaders ahead of veto day. Plus, Peer to Peer with Lee Strubinger features journalists who covered the session firsthand. And Seth Tupper explains why South Dakota lawmakers hear each and every bill that's filed in the 40-day session. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
As we celebrate 1,000 shows on SDPB, In the Moment evolves to meet your needs. Beginning Monday, March 29th, the In the Moment team unwraps an updated version of the program. We'll hear from a wider range of people, focus on topics you've told us you appreciate, and shine a light on the place we call home. Listen to In the Moment with Lori Walsh, middays and evenings, beginning March 29th on SDPB Radio. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, as South Dakota emerges from winter and blossoms into spring, we pause for a reminder about how to take care of your skin. Okay, year-round. Dr. Kelly Evans is an internal medicine physician with the Vera Medical Group in Brookings and a member of the On Call with the Prairie Doc team, and she joins us to talk a little bit about what might be ailing your skin. Dr. Evans, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Great to be here again.
Tonight's On Call with the Prairie Doc is all about rashes, moles, and growths, and all the things that can happen to your skin. Tell us a little bit about the program.
Yeah, so tomorrow night we will have our typical program. Our guest is my friend Mandy Greenway, a dermatologist who works at Avera and Mitchell. And so we're going to focus somewhat on rashes and skin disorders that cause rashes, but are going to be glad to take any skin-related questions that we can have the experts answer for you. Dermatology is a fun topic. It's hard to it's hard to learn about dermatology without lots of pictures. So Dr. Greenway is going to supply some sort of, you know, pictures of some rashes and lesions that we can talk about and learn about.
All right. So we've done our obligatory wear sunscreen moment. Now let's talk about some of those things that are just, you know, worth ignoring and let going, you know, that's going to go away. And some of those things that really should, you should see your doctor, because the temptation is to ignore or do that online Google search for pictures and never make the call. Let's start with some of the things that definitely for sure you need to go see your physician for.
Yeah. So the big bad thing in dermatology, the biggest and baddest of them probably is melanoma. And so this can be tricky because there are some moles that are just moles, and there are some, you know, there's a specific type of mole called a seborrheic keratosis that's very common and benign, but can sometimes have some features of melanoma. So the things to look for in a mole really have to do with regularity. So are there borders that are irregular? Is it not look symmetric? That might be a concerning finding. Is the color not regular throughout the whole mole? Is it growing quickly or has it changed quickly? Those are all things that might tip you off to go see at least your primary care doctor to have them initially look at it and decide whether the mole is worrisome enough to warrant a biopsy, because those are things that you're right, you just don't want to ignore, Lori.
Is this a hereditary or genetic condition? How much of this is about, you know, where you come from, and how much about is it about what you've done, you know, for work, being out in the sun, for example? Mm-hmm. Like, what's nature, sure. What's nurture here?
Yeah, so melanoma, like many things, is kind of a combination of both. There are certainly genetic syndromes that can predispose people to having melanoma, things that are otherwise related to some cancer genes. And certainly the condition of someone's skin can predispose someone to melanoma. But people of all skin types can get melanoma, and certainly sun exposure is something that can predispose someone to having something transform into a melanoma. So it's a little of both. It's a little genetics. It's a little bit of the sun stuff. But there are people who do everything right. You know, like many cancers, there are some people who develop lung cancer and have never smoked a day in their life or had an exposure. That can be true of melanoma too. It's a little bit of both.
Let's talk about some of those rashes and other things, the eczemas and the psoriasis. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I'm wondering about things that can be exacerbated by stress, because everybody has had really a very, you know, difficult year during the pandemic with the disruption. Can that make some of these skin rashes and issues worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of hard to find tangible connections with some of those things with stress, but there's some things, like all chronic conditions, that certainly can be made worse by stress. And interestingly, kind of in a reverse, there's a lot of evidence that chronic skin conditions can cause stress, can cause anxiety, and can be linked to mood disorders, just partly because of the bother that it causes that individual person, but also because we as a society, you know, make a lot of judgments of people on the way they look. And so sometimes those skin conditions can cause people stress for that reason. But I mean, exceedingly common, especially in this part of the world in the wintertime, is eczema, just the dryness of our air helps a lot of people drive people into eczema. So we'll talk a lot about that tomorrow night. We'll talk about psoriasis, which is another kind of common autoimmune skin condition. And lots of other things.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about, you know, sunscreen and sunblock and sun protection, but let's leave us with some of the other things. Lotions, moisturizers, do more skin products help your skin do less? Are there final tips that you have for taking care of your skin other than, you know, reaching out to your doctor when there seems to be a problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's this huge market of skincare products that, you know, somewhat prey on just our societal aspects of what we think our skin should look like. And ultimately, everyone can have kind of different skin types and different needs. But in my view, simple is best. And so, you know, when people are having some irritated skin, I really urge them to stay away from a lot of fragrance in their skin products and that kind of thing. For certain skin disorders, especially things like eczema and things related to dryness, like the most tried and true thing is just plain old Vaseline without anything fancy in it. So I think, you know, people can spend a lot of money on skincare products, and that's probably not necessary from the standpoint of health of one's skin.
Dr. Kelly Evans is an internal medicine physician with the Vera Medical Group in Brookings. She's a member of the On Call with the Prairie Doc team. On Call with the Prairie Doc, you can see it Thursday nights at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB TV. You can also find them online at prairiedoc.org or search Prairie Doc on Facebook. Dr. Evans, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
Up next, the Dakota Political Junkies are with us. We'll talk about Governor Kristi Noem's Defend Title IX Now initiative. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
We're often told we can't rewrite the past. But what if we could?
It gave me the happiness that was taken away.
How understanding the stories of our lives and reimagining them can change us forever. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, Governor Kristi Noem says she is building a coalition of support to defend Title IX and the integrity of girls and women's sports. That nationwide plea for support hasn't gone exactly as planned. Opponents to the governor's efforts point out that House Bill 1217, even with the suggested style and form revisions, would block transgender girls and women from playing on sanctioned sports teams. They say it violates Title IX. On the other hand, some conservatives have lashed out at the governor for not moving forward quickly enough with legislation that codifies a gender binary and blocks those transgender athletes from girls' sports teams. Is the Defend Title IX Now effort a political misstep for Governor Noem, or is the conversation just getting started? John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and he joins us now as part of our Dakota Political Junkies conversation. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. It's great to be here.
It's great to hear your voice. We're going to talk a little bit about the politics, not of transgender girls playing sports, but really how this is playing out on a national stage for Governor Noem, her profile in the nation, her profile in South Dakota, and you know how kind of people are interpreting it. And we're going to start out with a little audio from an interview she did with Tucker Carlson. This is usually a safe space for her to go on national media and talk about her initiatives, but here is just a little bit of their exchange as Tucker challenged Governor Kristi Noem.
So you're saying the NCAA threatened you and you don't think you can win that fight. They said, if you sign this, we won't allow girls in South Dakota to play. And you don't think you can win in court, even though the public overwhelmingly supports you nationally. And so you're caving to the NCAA. I think that's what you're saying.
No, that's not right at all, Tucker. In fact, you're wrong completely.
Okay.
I've been working on this issue for years. In fact, several years ago, I fought USDA to make sure that 4-H rodeo and that the sport of rodeo could keep girls' events, and boys' events. So I've been working on this for many, many years. And back since November, I've been consulting with legal scholars and professors across the country, asking them, how do I protect women's sports? And they've gone through the steps to how I would legally challenge the NCAA and keep them from bullying the state of South Dakota. And what they've told me to do is that I need to build a coalition. So that's why today, I launched DefendTitleIXNow.com, and that's going to allow us to build a coalition of states that can fight the NCAA.
A little bit of Governor Christie. Now I'm talking with Tucker Carlson on his program about the Defend Title IX Now initiative. John Hunter is with us for the Dakota Political Junkies. John, were you surprised at a little bit of, you know, Glenn Beck came out in support of Governor Noem's position. Tucker Carlson sort of took her on his program. The national response has been somewhat inconsistent.
First of all, I'd rather listen to In the Moment than Tucker Carlson or any of the other national ones.
Thank you.
but here we are. So here we are. It is a little bit of a mixed review, and in response to your opening sentences there, I think this is just getting started. I don't think this is a definitive thing, and this discussion needs to happen more, and there will be ideological differences, and it may not be solvable or easily solvable, let's say. But I do think that the launching the Title IX thing that Governor Noem is a good move, and try to have discussions about this. But you're right. I mean, if you're asking about the kind of national profile of Governor Noem, she's taking a position that is not ultra conservative, which is in a lot of cases she has done that. I don't think it's harmful to her. I think she's actually, I think, standing up for something, whether it's what she believes or what she thinks is right or her advisors are told her. So I actually appreciated her response to the questions last night.
Yeah. So DefendTitleIXNow.com, when you go to that website, there's not much there. It's pretty much one page. Some athletes who are pictured in the, you know, sort of clip art are already speaking out about how they, you know, they shouldn't be featured there. There's a spot to put in your name and email and three bullet points about what the Defend Title IX Coalition actually is. It's a little unclear whether you're signing a petition, whether it's an email grab. What exactly are you defending? Do you think they thought fully through what that website to, you know, is this the way to build a coalition?
I totally concur, Lori, that it looks as though it was put together rather hastily, and that's not terrible. I mean, the websites change over time, and here we are right at the, you know, in the veto season of, or in this case, the style and form change mm-hmm. season. So I think this coalition was probably put together pretty quickly. Yes, there are some kind of endorsements that go with that and so forth. But no, that's why it kind of reinforces my thought of this is just getting started. And so what will this do? I think if you add your name to that, they will take that in. You'll start getting emails. You'll start being asked for money, right? That's mm-hmm. how these things seem to go. But I think it's just the start of this process, and I don't know if this coalition will matter. But I think her idea of binding together different states in a uniform manner to try to counter a little bit of the NCAA stuff is probably the right strategy.
All right. At the risk of giving more airtime to a national conversation, we're going to play a little bit of what Tucker asked her about the court of public opinion. Take a listen.
And I've been bullied for the last year by liberals, Tucker. I'm not going to let anybody from the NCAA, from any big business, I'm not going to even let conservatives on the right bully me. I'm going to solve the problem. I'm going to make sure that we're building strength in numbers and we're going after the NCAA and make sure that we're keeping only girls playing in girls' sports. I've been doing this for years, and I'm going to solve the problem, not just pick a fight to pick a fight.
Well, but the legislature, you're saying, was just picking a fight to pick a fight. I thought that they were trying to codify what the majority of
right.
your citizens want, which is girls' sports for girls and boys' sports for boys. Here the NCAA comes in and says, if you do that, you're going to lose a court battle. And so you said, well, the bill can't go forward. You have a democratic process that arose from your own citizens. They want this bill, and you've stopped it. So I'm not really sure how this is defending women's sport. No, with respect.
The bill, Tucker, The bill that my legislature gave me is a trial lawyer's dream. It creates more and more litigation and regulation that's impossible to comply with for families and for school districts and people going forward. What I'm interested in doing is making sure we're protecting girls' sports and we're going forward to fight the NCAA. And what we're going to do as well is if they don't fix this through the style and form revision, I'm going to ask them to introduce a new bill. If they don't do that, I'm going to immediately bring them back into a special session and tell them we're going to protect girls' sports through K through 12, and then we're going to go and fight the NCAA through a coalition to make sure that we can continue to protect Title IX and defend Title IX.
A little bit of Governor Kristi Noem talking to national reporter Tucker Carlson, and we've got John Hunter with the Madison Daily Leader to bring this conversation back home locally. A couple things to sort of tease apart there, John, and one is the sort of incredulousness with which Tucker Carlson says there was a democratic process and you overruled it. And I'm just quite sure a lot of people were thinking about medical marijuana and, you know, 70% of votes and the efforts to sort of slow that down. Do you think Governor Noem is on a little bit, sturdier ground here because she basically has been consistent in saying since the beginning, just because the lawmakers want it, just because people want it, doesn't mean it's constitutional, doesn't mean it's the right legislation. We have to do these things in the right way. That feels to me very consistent with what she said, whether you agree with it or not, consistent with what she said about some other policy initiatives. What are your thoughts on that?
Agreed. Yes, that it does feel consistent. You know, this legislation that's passed by both chambers of the South Dakota legislature go to the governor for signature. And she has different choices there. And again, let's just remove for a second the topic, but the process. And that is she can sign it, she can veto it, or she can send it back for suggested changes. And that's natural. It's not being particularly bold. Frankly, it happens almost every session that those kinds of things. Now, this is a fairly substantial change. So sometimes it said use the word should instead of will or something like that, but this is a little more substantial and basically keeps some of this, now back to the topic, keeps some of this in place for K-12 and then removes it for collegiate level, which again you're dealing with the NCAA. And so, then the legislature can choose to override that or they can, or to enact those changes or not act them, and then she's got another chance to veto it or send it back. But I do think it was rather bold of her to say, I'm going to call a special session just for this topic. And that's a little unusual, but she feels strongly enough about it that she has the right to do that. All of that is within the natural process of South Dakota law. So it isn't quite the same as, voting in something at the ballot box and then the legislature turning around and undoing it.
Right. So do you think that the attention she's getting from this nationwide, from a coalition and support of her to some of the attacks on her, is that an indication that she is being, once again noticed at that level? And is that a good thing? Or are we seeing her kind of get shot down and any policy misstep she makes is going to be even more obvious for any future political aspirations that she may or may not have?
That's really hard. That's a hard question. But I would ultimately say this. I think Governor Noem is doing what she believes is correct, and there's merit in doing that. You know, right or wrong, and frankly, this is a much more gray topic than being right or wrong on this kind of thing. So I think she's pursuing it in the manner that she believes is correct, that she has gotten from advice, and even though her enthusiasm for a thing has changed a little bit. You know, they keep on bringing up she's excited to sign this, as Tucker Carlson said early in the interview, and now she's making changes to it. That's certainly the prerogative of any elected official. Is, you know, early on you can say one thing, but it comes really down to the pen when you do sign it or you send it back or so forth. So I do think that she's doing all things within the framework of what she's allowed to do, what South Dakotans would ask any official to do, be thoughtful, try to do it. And we've asked her to, or any official, use your best judgment, try to do what you think is correct, and then go through the process. And again, this is the front end of this, right? It may be challenged. It could change next week, or next time they have a special session. NCAA may weigh in on this, I don't know, but But I do think she is being consistent. She's doing what I think she believes is correct.
Yeah. It's not just the NCAA, it's also the Convention Visitor Bureau Association and others. You know, we've received several notes from people who are transgender or who are experts in, gender issues and gender specialists who say she doesn't talk to any of those people to really get the facts on the ground. So it might be easy to stand up and say boys should be in this line and girls should be in this line. But those notions are not accurate, what she's getting up and saying. And I want to ask you this, during the press conference in Sioux Falls, one of the reporters was pressing her on, just this discriminates against or this impacts transgender athletes. And she was like, no, it doesn't. And he said, I'm sorry, I've forgotten who asked the question right now. But he said, if it doesn't impact transgender athletes, who does it impact? And she just said, girls, females, women, girls and women, that's it. And she's been accused of just trying to make transgender athletes invisible in this conversation. So is she doing enough, when she builds a coalition on one side, is she doing enough to get information from the people who are saying, now, wait a minute, you don't have the right information here. You don't understand the science of this well enough. Let's do some education. Do you think she's doing enough to deal with some of her other opponents, which are coming from a different angle?
Probably not yet, but I think she probably will. The question being, is she doing enough on this? And remember, this is kind of an evolving discussion nationwide, worldwide, as we understand this kind of gender participation and so forth. If you look at the bill itself that the legislature passed, remember, she didn't introduce this thing, but as the legislature passed it, they spend the first several paragraphs kind of defining these things and using quotes to say, here's what boys, here's what happens at conception, here's what happens at birth, here's what happens at adolescence and so forth, and how those are different. Well, that's fine, and that's all true, but there's this kind of evolving middle area where we don't understand it quite so well. And we'd love to define it, yes, boys and yes, girls, because it's easier. But it's become a harder topic than we thought in the past. And so I think she probably will learn from it as this thing goes along. We had the whole bathroom thing going on in the legislature, too, and I think that's largely being resolved, that saying that, everyone deserves privacy, and you kind of, we don't have kind of the group situations in new buildings like we used to. So I think you can learn over time and understand and listen and do that kind of thing. And I would guess that that's part of the reason why this website is feels early in this, because I think we're still learning.
Yeah. And a lot of the information, those first two paragraphs in the bill, I think is some of the information that's been overlooked. I agree with you. But I would say a lot of it, as I read it, was really inaccurate to our current understandings of how gender identity and how gender assignment at birth really happens. So to your point of this being a good conversation, this is a really hard conversation for a lot of people because it feels like yet another attack on their very existence. It's a good, positive conversation if it's held respectfully, because we get to open our understanding about what this means and how it impacts everybody's lives, and hopefully move toward, through civil conversation, a greater understanding of things. Would you agree with that, John?
We've seen that many times in many topics where our understanding at one point then evolves with civil discussion and so forth. And it doesn't say it has to be thrown out or reversed or upside down or anything like that, but it can evolve over time with circumstances and understanding and so forth. So I think of a lot of different topics that we, and I don't want to equate this discussion with any other particular one, but think of things from 100 years ago or 200 years ago, things that people thought turns out to be not complete.
Nope.
And that's not to say it was wrong, but we still were in. Thank goodness for the human evolution that we keep learning and understanding, and we don't know. We have no idea where this is going to end up. At least I don't.
Well, and I guess I would. Yeah,
I would just close with this, you know, the idea of women in sports and all the things that we've heard the governor say and lawmakers say about the superiority of the male athlete. And it just kind of makes me chuckle because we used to think women couldn't run marathons because their uteruses would fall out and they were pulled off of, you know, marathon courses. And it was a lot of brave women who went out and said, no, this is something we can do. We didn't think men could break the 4-minute mile until it happened. So it just seems like there's a whole lot that we are underestimating about athletes. And I, for one, look forward to the future as we learn more what people are capable of, including transgender athletes. John Hunter, thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Yeah. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay, take care.
Doug Greenway grew up near Mitchell. After a career in education, he became the director of the Corn Palace, and he's been that director for just over a year. His perspective on the building has changed through the years, but the corn jokes, well, some things never change.
My view of the Corn Palace is from a young boy going on the rise and how big a place it was to then coming here to compete, you know, in high school to now as the director has changed, and I have a new appreciation for what I guess the tourism side of it is, whether they're a tourist or, if to me, someone from Mount Vernon drives 12 miles to come to a ball game, mm-hmm. and make sure they have a good experience too. Main streets all over South Dakota and the Midwest are shrinking, and the Corn Palace is on Main Street. When I took this job, my goal was to work with Main Street businesses and have events that bring people here. We know we're an important part of Mitchell, we're an important part of Main Street, and I want to leave the Corn Palace in a better place than I found it and add a few things, make sure it's maintained appropriately, have clever, creative murals for the public to view. Our new theme has been announced for 2022. That's going to be a circus theme under the Big Top for 2022. We're going to have a Big Top circus tent on one of our murals. We're going to have, of course, elephants murals. We're going to have three tigers jumping through fiery rings in the mural number 3 over here on the corner. So as people come down Main Street, they'll see these tigers leaping out at them. We're pretty excited to see our circus thing come to life, which will start this summer and into the fall. You know, we have a few things that, you know, when someone spills, it's a corntastrophe that we have. But, you know, we like to use the word maze a lot, you know. This is amazing. Yeah, it is. Make sure you spell that correctly with M-A-I-Z-E. Yes. So, and of course, people should know when they come here, they might see Cornelius, our mascot for our Mitchell Colonels, prowling the Corn Palace lobby, too.
Greenway is looking forward to a return to normal for the Corn Palace, hosting the Mitchell Farmers Market throughout the summer in the plaza, tens of thousands of tourists, and the Corn Palace Festival this August. Up next, is saving the planet in the hands of governments and corporations, or is there really something each of us can do? Climate scientist Kimberly Nicholas joins us. You're in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Callum Borchers. Vaccines have helped contribute to a dramatic drop in COVID-19 cases at the nation's nursing homes, but vaccination rates among long-term care staff are still far lower than those of residents. And that concerns some experts in the field who are working to educate the hesitant. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, presenting Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ this Saturday in the Washington Pavilion of Sioux Falls. Tickets available at sdsymphony.org.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. State lawmakers considered more than 500 pieces of legislation this year. We reviewed the key issues with legislative leaders ahead of Veto Day. Plus, Peer to Peer with Lee Strubinger features journalists who covered the session firsthand. And Seth Tupper explains why South Dakota lawmakers hear each and every bill that's filed in the 40-day session. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, building lasting relationships that transcend generations, representing a variety of industries and employment matters, including defense of workers' comp claims, experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Kimberly Nicholas grew up with strong agricultural connections. Her grandfather, in fact, is responsible for revolutionizing the kind of turkey that graces most of our Thanksgiving tables, and she knows an awful lot about wine. As she became a climate scientist, she brought with her a deep affection for ag families and practices, alongside an urgency to move to a regenerative mindset in the industry. Nicholas is now a leading global sustainability scientist who knows the data about climate change better than almost anyone. What's missing, she says in her latest book, is transforming that scientific knowledge into personal and practical action for each one of us. Her book is called Under the Sky We Make. Dr. Nicholas joins us now. Kimberly Nicholas, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
You're in South Dakota now, just a strong agricultural, foundation here, and lots of listeners who work in farming and ranching are kind of trying to deal with the science and the changing climate here in the state. Tell us a little bit about your grandfather's legacy to begin and how that fits into your concept of, you know, this exploitation mindset versus a regenerative mindset.
Sure. Well, I come from a farming family, as you said, in Sonoma, California, which is north of San Francisco. Five generations of my family were in agriculture there. And as you mentioned, my grandfather, George, bred a new kind of turkey that became the Maine meat turkey. And what my work over the last two decades has been focused on is documenting the impacts that our food system is having on the natural world and on our health. And in my book, I'm trying to argue that what we need to do is move from a relationship right now that's more like we're at war with nature to one where we're working with rather than against nature. So farming causes about a quarter of our carbon pollution, our climate pollution in total, and we need to move to a kind of farming that is regenerative, as you said, so working with the principles of nature and on a more human scale.
The five irrefutable facts about climate scientists. It's warming, it's us. Tell us a little bit about that, just to help solidify in people's minds, especially this idea that there's something that can still be done.
Yes, so what science tells us about climate change and really everything we need to know is it's warming, it's us, we're sure, it's bad, but we can fix it. Most Americans now are in a group that's the Yale Center on Climate Communication calls concerned or alarmed. So that means they know that our human activities like burning fossil fuels and deforestation are causing the warming we're experiencing now. They see the effects, and as you mentioned, I think farming families and communities are really on the front lines there in dealing with the impacts that we've already had from about 1 degree Celsius of warming so far. And they're worried about it, and they know that it's harming communities around the world, including right here at home. But where people kind of, where there's a gap and that I'm trying to fill in this book is to connect with the research on what we know actually works and what we need to do to stabilize the climate and to have a good life for both people and thriving nature on Earth.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because this book is personal, it's passionate, and it's, how hard was it for you to kind of, or was that an easy transition to sort of shift from, like, I have all this data and science and I think like a scientist, but really to make things happen, I also have to think very much like a human being and a scientist, like an emotional person and a scientist, like a humanities thinker. And like, tell me a little bit about that balance for you to get beyond some of the data on a spreadsheet to really making meaningful change in people's lives.
Yeah, it's really been a journey for me. I mean, my training is in ecology and in climate science, and I'm used to crunching the numbers and reporting on the facts. And that is, of course, very important. But I think increasingly I was having the personal experience of living through a time of climate change, seeing the impacts on people and places that I love. I first did scientific research in 1996. I was a research assistant to one of my undergraduate professors, and we were out documenting how already back then, almost 25 years ago, plants and communities were shifting in California and actually moving uphill because the world was warming around them. So, you know, enough time has gone by and we've seen enough warming to really see the impacts. And one thing that made it really personal for me is that my family is still in Northern California, And the devastating, catastrophic wildfires there for the last 5 years have just been so difficult to live through. And, you know, my family has evacuated. Thankfully, they were safe, but we have friends who lost homes. And we know that those fires are made bigger and more dangerous and more likely and harder to contain by human-caused warming. So at the point when I'm fearing for my family's life, it goes from being, you know, it's not just about data and statistics anymore. It really gets to the heart of everything I love and care about is really bound up with the climate.
When you're caring about those people and dealing with it at such a personal level, and other people in the national news coverage are saying, this is really not about climate change, it's really about forest management. As a scientist, what did you bring to that argument?
Well, it is true that there have been policies of fire suppression for the last 100 years that have contributed to fuel buildup and have made wildfires worse and more likely to spread. But that's only part of the question, and that really illustrates a common theme with climate change, that it's kind of a threat multiplier. It really cranks up the volume or turns up the heat and pressure on systems that have, systems that have many interacting parts. So basically, as I write about, the goal in fire science is a paradigm shift away from complete control, which is frankly impossible, to living better with fire. And that needs to include both getting at root causes, so removing, having prescribed burns and management that removes fuel buildup and is more like the natural cycles of a forest, for example, but also we have to stabilize the climate, and to do that, we're going to have to stop using fossil fuels.
When we talk about communication and really translating climate science to everyday people who are busy and, you know, have all kinds of things happening and don't want massive disruption to our lives, I'm wondering if climate scientists learned from public health experts or epidemiologists during the pandemic what works and what doesn't work during such a crisis, that you know, said, hey, here's when people really listen to those, to those facts and how much we cared about it and we're tuning into it every single day. And here's where some of that communication, you know, faltered. Are there lessons to be learned from the scientific community about messaging that were revealed during the global pandemic?
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, both from good and less good examples. I mean, we see the importance of clear and timely communication and expertise, and we see that people really value and want to hear from experts, and that's shown by data as well, if we're talking about climate as well as public health. So I think that is a really important trust that society puts in scientists and experts to share our knowledge and to use it for public benefit, especially in cases of crisis or emergency where it's really essential to act on that information. I think one thing we can also learn is that we know that it's not only facts. Facts are that motivate and change behavior or are what people need to hear. We need to connect facts with feelings and action. And that's what I try to do in the book through these personal stories, taking and translating the facts from research and exploring how they've affected my own life and harnessing that energy and passion and emotion from feelings to motivate action.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable book. Tell us, and let's focus the rest of our time here on what some of those actions might be. When people say, you know, you're on an airplane with someone and they say, I just feel so hopeless. Maybe it's funny that you're on an airplane while this conversation is happening. But and they say, I just don't know what to do. Where do you begin?
Yes, I've had a lot of those conversations, and I had those folks in mind, and I hope to reach them with this book, because I know that a lot of people are in that place of feeling hopeless or overwhelmed. So I think starting with realizing that we're not alone in this, that actually the majority of Americans are already concerned or alarmed about climate change. They know that it's happening, and it's us, and it's bad. They even support policies and changes in practice to solve the problem. But then people get stuck and don't know what that looks like, what that means in their own lives. So I think recognizing, actually, we have so much latent energy, so much, you know, potential energy, and surveys show this repeatedly. People really do care about this issue. They're ready to act, but we need to energize and motivate people and get them pointed in the right direction so we can use our time and energy well.
Yeah. One of the things that I think we all remember from the early days of the pandemic, when so much shut down, so much global industry shut down, we stopped driving our cars, was that you could very quickly see the world in many communities start to change. And there was a sense of wonder and celebration about that sort of rewilding of American cities. And then there was also a deep sense of it took that much for those things. Like, people are out of work. Like, we can't sustain this level of not doing anything. And that also discouraged people. What would you say some of those lessons are as we watch the global economy grind to a halt? Because it can't grind to a halt forever. And yet, look what happened when it paused.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of important lessons from the pandemic. One, as you mentioned, is there was a real and substantial drop in pollution, and the biggest decrease in climate pollution was from less driving. So that had a really big effect. But of course, nobody would want these changes to happen for the reasons they did, and the suffering and sacrifice that it caused during the pandemic. I mean, that's not, now we need to make changes for the right reasons and in the right ways that protect people, protect jobs, protect well-being and health and communities, while at the same time are directed at quickly reducing our climate pollution and getting us on track to stabilize the climate.
Yeah. So what's next? People should do what? Drive less? More, you know, keep those Zoom meetings going if you can. And you don't necessarily have to fly across the country for a board meeting. 30 seconds of what should we think about first?
Well, those kind of personal choices for high emitters are really important. And what our research shows is that flying, driving, and meat consumption are the areas where individuals can have the biggest impact. And focusing behavior change there is really important for high emitters. But we also, at the same time, need to focus on changing the systems, the economic incentives, the political system, and really the culture of what we value and lift up in the media and through all kinds of culture, because both that kind of systemic change and the kind of personal action from high-emitting individuals is necessary.
Yeah, it's really one of the best written and most useful books on climate science and how it impacts your daily lives and things that you can do. It's a hopeful book in a lot of ways, but also an incredibly realistic and informed one. So Kimberly Nicholas is Associate Professor of Sustainability Science at Lund. It's Sweden's highest ranking university. And her book is called Under the Sky We Make. It's available now. Dr. Nicholas, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori. I really appreciate it.